Good evening. Good evening. My name is Yvonne Ryden. I'm from the Department of Geography and Environment, and I'm chairing the session this evening. Professor Tony Giddens sends his apologies, but he's had to attend an event in Berlin. It's a great pleasure to welcome you to this year's Miliband Fellow Public Lecture. The department has been particularly honoured to have David Harvey as Miliband Fellow within the department over the last few years. David Harvey holds the post of Professor of Anthropology at the City University of New York, but has been able to spend the Lent term with us for three of the past 4 years under the terms of the Miliband Fellowship. His latest book describes him as unquestionably the most influential as well as the most cited geographer of his generation, and I think nobody would dispute that. His output has been phenomenal, not only in quantity, but also in range. While firmly based in a historical materialist analysis, he has tackled topics as diverse as postmodernist readings of cinema, the environmental justice movement, and the metaphor of the architect. Those less familiar with the range of David Harvey's writings will be well advised to invest in his latest work, Spaces of Capital, which has been published by Edinburgh University Press, because it brings together key articles from 1974 right through to 2000, as well as new chapters which have not been previously published. It's an excellent introduction. The linking thread through all this work has always been the way in which his writings and lectures stimulate thought and debate, and we are therefore very much looking forward to tonight's lecture, which goes under the title Geographical Knowledges, Political Powers. Professor David Harvey.
The topic I want to address is the role of geographical knowledges in politics. And I want to begin with a simple observation, and that is that historically, if you care to look back, you'd find that revolutions in political activity and revolutions in economic well-being and revolutions in what we now call globalization, been going on for a very long time, have usually been accompanied by radical restructurings of geographical knowledge. And in some instances, you could argue that they have been provoked by these radical restructurings. And the background of what I want to talk about is largely what has been happening over the past few years in terms of this phenomenon we call globalization, and in what ways it is generating the need for a completely different kind of geographical knowledge, and what kind of geographical knowledge that could be, and how we're going to decide about that knowledge. Now, I use the plural geographical knowledges for three reasons. One, very minor. And the very minor reason is because there is a discipline called geography, believe it or not, even though I happen now to be called an anthropologist. And the discipline of geography is an interesting mix of thinking and ideas. Any discipline that can range from paleoecology through GIS to queer theory in the city obviously has some kind of identity problem. And it seems to me, even from the standpoint of the discipline of geography, it's very important to pluralize the idea of geographical knowledges, because every now and again somebody in the discipline decides there is an essence of geographical thinking, and they try to impose that essence upon the rest of the discipline, and it always turns out badly. So we should probably among ourselves, those of us who are in geography, recognize that there are multiple knowledges within our midst, and we should be interested in as much in the differences of those knowledges as in the commonalities. But that, as I said, is a minor reason. The major reason has to do with what I think is a very incontrovertible fact, which is that geographical knowledges are produced and used all over the place outside of the discipline of geography, and I'm therefore not concerned specifically with what goes on inside of the discipline of geography. I'm interested in how geographical knowledges get produced in all kinds of institutional settings and how they get used. And I think these questions that then arise about the uses of geographical knowledge start to take on very considerable political and public importance, because those knowledges frame a lot of political action and frame a lot of ways of thinking about the world. And it is that larger area that I want to address tonight. The third reason is perhaps a more peculiar reason. And it is that I'm of the firm belief that the whole kind of structure of knowledge production in academia has to undergo a radical transition. How it is that we arrived at a situation where there were separate disciplines called anthropology and geography and history and sociology and political science and economics is a long, long history. But in itself, it seems to me that those divisions have become increasingly dysfunctional in relationship to the kinds of knowledge structures that we need to address major issues, global poverty, environmental issues, political rights, cultural diversity, and the like. Now, to say that all of those disciplines have become irrelevant is not to say that the content that they have over the years defined is irrelevant. It just has to be taken out of a particular context of a sort of a territorial turf of a discipline and put into a completely different configuration. And in a sense, that's what I want to do tonight in relationship to geographical knowledges, which is to say there are forms of geographical knowledge which are going to be incorporated somehow or other into any kind of new framework of knowledge, and the question arises, how will that knowledge be incorporated? Now, last time I gave a lecture here, it was on the topic of cosmopolitanism, and I thought this might also provide a useful starting point to recapitulate a couple of the points that I made in that particular lecture. And the reason that this became important is because the whole kind of question of the regulatory framework that might be placed around this world of neoliberal market exchange, which has really come to dominate over the past 20, 30 years, the whole question of how that regulatory framework is going to be set up, what kinds of ethical principles it's going to be founded upon, is one which is coming very much into the fore of debate, because I think there's absolutely no question that some sort of regulatory framework is in the offing. We already have it in the WTO. We already have it in some other institutional settings. And so the question is, what kind of ethical basis is going to be there? And cosmopolitanism has been one of those bases that have been proposed. Now, in the original argument I made about cosmopolitanism, it was to kind of say, well, there's an issue here which needs to be addressed. And I guess the best way to approach that issue is to go back to Martha Nussbaum, who is one of the sort of advocates of this, and to read something that she wrote in one of her key pieces. She made the argument, and it's sort of intriguing to read it now, that the United States is unable to look at itself through the lens of the other, and as a consequence is equally ignorant of itself, precisely because the population is so appallingly ignorant of the rest of the world. And she goes on to say, in order to construct any adequate global dialogue, we need knowledge, not only of the geography and ecology of other nations, something that would already entail much revision of our curricula, but also a great deal about their people, so that in talking with them, we may be capable of respecting their traditions and commitments. Cosmopolitan education would supply the background necessary for this deliberation. In other words, she's saying cosmopolitanism, without a sound and proper understanding of geography and anthropology, that kind of cosmopolitanism is an empty ideal. Now, the problem was that Nussbaum paid no attention to what kind of geographical knowledge was going to be implied in this new educational system, and that's one of the issues that I wanted to address. And in addressing it, I first went back to Kant, who's one of the founders of this whole kind of cosmopolitan ethic and one of the key figures that everybody refers to, and looked at Kant's geography, because Kant indeed had taught geography. He taught it 49 times in his life. It was the second most important course he ever taught. He also taught anthropology 25 times in his life, so he attached great importance to both geography and anthropology. The anthropology is published in English, the geography is not, and there's a very good reason why, because it's basically a bunch of anecdotic kind of rubbish, all sort of strung together with absolutely no attempt at systematization whatsoever, which is a very peculiar thing to find Kant writing this and allowing this to happen in the midst of all of the other things that he was justly famous for. But even worse than it being anecdotic and completely all over the place, the geography contains the following sorts of commentaries. Humanity achieves its greatest perfection with the white race. The yellow Indians have somewhat less talent. The Negroes are much inferior, and some of the peoples of the Americas are well below them. Well, that's still true, right? The Hottentots are dirty and you can smell them from far away. The Javanese are thieving, conniving and servile, sometimes full of rage and at other times craven with fear. The Samoyeds are timid, lazy, superstitious and given to strong drink. Burmese women wear indecent clothing and like to get pregnant by Europeans. It just goes on and on and on like this. Now this actually poses a very interesting question. If you have a cosmopolitan ethic, which is about, you know, justice and about morality and the like, and then you project it into a world where the geographical knowledge is constructed in this kind of way, you can see immediately a certain kind of problem. And the structure of the problem can be simply recorded as this. You know, either the Hottentots have to wash and the Burmese women have to stop getting pregnant by Europeans in order to be incorporated in the cosmopolitan ethic. So you say, you know, in order for them to be part of this, they have to be like us. Or you take the ethic and you put it upon this highly differentiated world with the consequence that you render even more injustice than there was before by having it as a discriminatory code placed upon this variety of geographical difference. Now this doesn't only apply, it turns out, to the cosmopolitan ethic. It applies to liberalism. It applies to neoliberalism. Liberalism proposed a theory of society which is based on the notion of a deracinated individual, an individual who has certain qualities and moral endowments and all the rest of it. So the whole theory rests on that person who has no specific place. And at the same time, out of that could come a whole kind of set of ethical principles and ideals. For instance, the ideals of somebody like John Stuart Mill, who could talk about equality and representative government and all the rest of it. And there's a very brilliant book by Uday Mehta called Liberalism and Empire, in which he poses the fundamental question. How could John Stuart Mill, interested in all these questions of representative governance and all the rest of it, how could he justify keeping India under the tutelage of empire? How could he justify doing that? And the answer, as with the Kantian thing, lies very much in the nature of the geographical details and the geographical conception. Because there were three images which can be actually laid out in relationship to imperial activities. One is that the imperial power declares the territory to be empty, terra nullius, it's empty. This is what, for example, Vancouver did when he went and mapped Vancouver Island. He mapped it, and it's a physical terrain. He made absolutely no mention whatsoever of any inhabitants in the area and any political organization in the area. It was therefore an empty terrain which could be easily settled by any colonial group. This is what John Locke did to the whole of North America. He said, basically, the indigenous populations have failed to mix their labor with the land in the right kind of way. Therefore, they do not belong. They are part of nature. Therefore, they don't exist. So this is one way, is to declare the population to be non-existent, to erase its existence. The second way is to actually consider them to be savages, to consider them barbarians, to consider them to be somehow outside of civilization. And from that standpoint, they do not deserve to be incorporated. They are there, but they do not deserve to be incorporated. They deserve to be disciplined, punished, incorporated, if necessary, brought into the cosmopolitan ethic or into liberal theory, because they're savages and they don't deserve anything better than that. This leads, as you will find in the whole history of thinking about the world, to what I would call the whole kind of process of demonization of particular spaces. Spaces inhabited by barbarians and savages that need, therefore, to be disciplined through military power, through coercion, through might. The third technique, and this was very strongly present in India, was infantilization. They are children, little children. They haven't yet grown up. And remember, John Locke kind of placed great emphasis upon education and kind of said, you know, in order for this individual to be mature enough to be able to participate in democratic, they have to be educated. And so essentially the Indian population is depicted as childlike, unable to make decisions for itself, needing strong parental guidance. So what does John Stuart Mill do? Well, he simply says, well, you know, they're immature. They need educating. They need the tutelage in order to bring them into this, into sort of the liberalism of empire. Now, this whole kind of habit seems to me to be extremely important. to look at. I want to argue that American foreign policy right now exhibits nearly all of those elements. Demonization. Ronald Reagan used to love to talk about the evil empire. After that, we had rogue states. That was Clinton's favorite term. Now we have the axis of evil. And so what this does is to actually convert the world into a certain territorial configuration where these evil spaces are there, and once they're defined as evil in the population's mind, they are entirely open to be attacked, destroyed, disciplined, coerced, and it is perfectly legitimate to do so. So that folk in the United States can think they're doing a wonderfully good job for the rest of the world by dropping bombs in Kosovo or doing what they're doing in Afghanistan or what they're thinking of doing in Iraq. Precisely because there are evil spaces that need to be disciplined in that way. Then there's the infantilization, that people need to be sort of brought into living how we live. And most Americans believe that the rest of the world would really like to be like them. And wanting to believe that, they then act in such a way by kind of saying, well, they're junior versions of us, and therefore we need to bring them into this whole kind of political realm of what neoliberalism is all about and what the particular American ethic is all about. Now, I want to argue then that this way of constructing the world has a very specific kind of political function. And it leads immediately into the question of how should spaces, different spaces of the world, be constructed, and who gets to construct them that way? How is it that somebody like Bush can actually define particular countries as being part of an axis of evil and get away with it? Now, there was a very interesting poll that came out in the United States about 3 years ago, and the poll said that the more people knew about a place, the less likely they were to support sanctions or military interventions against that place. And it sort of went through this in considerable detail. So what it said was, the more geographical knowledge, the more knowledge somebody had of this stuff, the more likely they were to have a very critical stance in relationship to what government policy was doing in relationship to that place. What I found fascinating about this poll was, I eventually discovered, with the help of a Reuters correspondent, that the poll was actually taken by Exxon. And the reason that Exxon had commissioned it, and the New York Times report, by the way, didn't say it had been commissioned by Exxon. The reason Exxon had commissioned it was because it wanted the sanctions lifted against Iran. And it was trying to figure out a way to do it. And the way to do it was to create better understanding of what Iran was about, and then the popular support for sanctions would start to disappear. This is a very simple example of an instrumental use of a certain kind of geographical knowledge for a certain kind of purpose. And it leads in immediately to the question, who constructs this geographical knowledge? Where does it come from? What is it about? And what are its main characteristics? Now, it's a long time, it seems to me, since Foucault taught us that we should really start to think about the relationship between institutions, the knowledges they construct, and how those knowledges are, for them, a very specific form of power. And it seemed very important, therefore, to look at institutional sites, a whole series of institutional sites where geographical knowledge gets constructed in relationship to playing these kinds of political power games and to understand the dynamics of what happens. Now, I've written a very long version of this paper where I start to look at a whole series of different sites, but you can see immediately, if I mention just a couple of them, how different these sites begin to look. Let's suppose we're looking at the production of geographical knowledge through the tourist industry. I mean, this has a fantastic impact on popular imagination. Almost all of us at some point or other are strongly exposed to exactly what this tourist industry is doing. And of course, the image of the world that comes from the tourist industry and the sort of notion of what's there and how we get there and social relations and spatial relations and ecology and environment and all those kinds of things have a very definite way of being depicted. I mean, crudely put, I mean, what is the tourist industry into? It's into sort of sex and sand and sun and sea and a little bit of culture kind of thrown in. So the geographical vision of the world gets caught up in a certain kind of way of understanding it. And of course, the tourist industry is not at all interested in producing geographical knowledge about, say, the prevalence of AIDS or the AIDS epidemic. It's not interested in talking about global impoverishment. It's not interested in talking about social struggle and conflict on the ground. It's not interested in talking about any of those things. So it produces a particular kind of knowledge which is functional in relationship to its own specific agenda. And this is what I mean by a site for the production of a certain kind of geographical knowledge, which is overwhelming in many respects in terms of our understanding of the world. And you can go through a whole set of other sites. The way in which, say, the media and film do their job, how they depict things, how we understand what the world is about through those kinds of images. And then you could look at the way in which multinational corporations produce a rather secretive kind of geographical knowledge, because they're interested not in a public form of geographical knowledge, they're interested in privileged information. For them, privileged geographical knowledge is a form of distinctive power to themselves, and they don't want to release it to anybody else. That is, if they know a revolt is brewing somewhere else, they don't want to let their rivals know about it. Let them go invest there and lose their investments, not them. So these are the kinds of things that start to produce a very special kind of privatized geographical knowledge within the multinational corporations and the financial institutions. And in relationship to that, of course, there's a whole range of consultancies who are exactly doing this. I mean, this is how Henry Kissinger has made his livelihood ever since he left office. It's sort of through consultancy, trying to tell people exactly what's going on in this place, what's going on in that place, and it's this kind of information that then becomes crucial in terms of investment decisions. There are NGOs who produce a vast amount. Consider the amount of information produced through something like Oxfam or CARE or Amnesty International or some of the women's rights groups. I mean, this here too, or some of the labor rights groups. Here too, there is a vast amount of information that gets produced in relationship to very specific kinds of issues and specific kinds of objectives. And then, of course, there are the other institutions, such as the supranational governmental institutions, like the World Bank, the United Nations, the WTO, and all the rest of it. There are all these kinds of institutional sites which are beavering away producing certain kinds of geographical information. And above all, there is, of course, the nation state, and with its interest in military, its interest in governance, its interest in geopolitics, and sometimes its interest in colonialism and imperial conquest. And finally, there is something which is really kind of interesting to look at, which is the whole issue of local knowledges. What are local geographical knowledges about? Sometimes there are very, very intense, very, very deeply structured forms of knowledge which are embedded in sort of cultural habits and ways of life. And these are often very recalcitrant forms of knowledge which are very hard to shift, very hard to transform. And they exist at a popular level, they exist at a local level, and therefore they are also an important, significant part of the political picture. Now I want to say just a couple of things about this mix of knowledges. First off, I want to look a little bit at the nation state and how the nation state utilizes geographical knowledge. From its very inception, it seems to be important to recognize that a geographical imaginary was at work in the whole creation of a nation state. Benedict Anderson likes to talk about the nation state and as an imagined community. Well, part of its imagining is a geographical imagining. And there are two aspects to it in terms of nation state formation which I think are important, and they can be briefly summarized in terms of bonding and bounding. The bounding is about trying to define a territorial entity of some kind which has some kind of coherence and has some kind of validity. And out of that comes an almost an objective attempt about bounding spaces in very specific kinds of ways. And it has led very much to a very strong association historically between this activity of bounding and the rise of cartographic techniques and cartographic skills. The bonding, however, is something completely different. It's about trying to create an effective unity between a population and a territory, and using a certain kind of rhetoric about the relationship between us and the land, between us and our history, us and our culture, using it in a very specific kind of way to try to bring together people into a kind of social relationship in which they believe they have something very deeply in common. And that commonality then is the basis for certain kinds of political action, certain kinds of political work. Now, a lot of that bonding is not done through specific, as it were, specific geographical kind of texts. A lot of it is done through a whole range of activities. It can be done through songs, it can be done through poetry, it can be done through literature. If you think back about, to Shakespeare, and you think back about a lot of the imagery, the metaphysical poets, a lot of it is precisely about trying to create a sense of national identity through some sort of notion of relationship to the land, and often it has a very strong environmental trace. The notion of German national identity and its association with forests and all those kinds of things, Welsh and their mountains, I mean, there's a long sort of history of that sort of bonding actually being sort of talked about through this process of identifying certain environmental characteristics and saying they have a lot to do with the creation of national identity. Now, this whole kind of issue has not gone away. One of the things that is most striking to me about living in the United States since September the 11th is that this has actually provoked an incredible recrudescence of a nationalist project, which is very much about a certain kind of bonding as well as a certain kind of bounding. And if you want to look at what I think is one of the biggest transitions that's occurred from the Clinton administration to the Bush administration, is the Clinton administration was as imperialist, but it wanted to do its imperialism through what you might call indirect rule, and that therefore multiculturalism and all that kind of thing was actually fundamental to its agenda. The Bush administration is going to do it by direct rule, and it's also have no tolerance or little tolerance for multiculturalism within the bound. Everybody now has to be an American, everybody has to wave the flag, and there's an incredible kind of push almost nationalistically to try to resurrect a lot of these symbols of national unity, of national identity within the American media and also through the administration. So here you see, it seems to me, nation-state formation is a very geographical affair. It always was a geographical affair. It continues to be very much a geographical affair, and there's some wonderful studies of this coming out. There's a great book on Siam Mat, which is about the geobody of a nation, which deals with this. Geographer Pasi in Finland has a wonderful kind of description of how Finnish national identity got forged in the 19th century. The beginning of the 19th century, most people who lived in the area we now call Finland didn't know they lived in Finland. They lived in communities and in communes, and they had relationships with communes right by, nearby or sometimes a little bit further away, and that was it. They didn't really think of themselves as belonging to some place called Finland. But it took incredible work of ethnographers, of ethnomusicologists, of literary figures, of historians, and all sorts of cultural workers. And above all, it took the creation of a map which was about Finnish national identity. And by the end of the 19th century, people in Finland knew they lived in a place called Finland. So here it is, a creation of a national identity through a process of this kind. But the state is, of course, also very interested in other elements. The other elements it's interested in governmentality. And as Ralph Miliband sort of reminded us, the state is not a homogeneous entity. It is really an ensemble of different institutions, many of which are often competing with each other and working at loggerheads with each other. And that means, in effect, that the different geographical knowledges produced within the state institutions vary a great deal according to the nature of the governmentality that they have in mind. For taxation purposes, you need this. For administration of, say, agriculture and fisheries, you need that. For industrial location, you need something else. So here you find a whole range of different knowledges which are being produced within the state apparatus, which are tightly connected to some kind of question of governmentality. And one of the issues which arises here is that it's not always clear what is the nature of the geographical knowledge which is appropriate. There are many failures of government projects and government institutional projects because they didn't get the knowledge right, the geographical knowledge right. And so they have to go back and rethink. Now, here is an open space into which many people can start to say, well, no, we should, if we thought about the geographical knowledge this way, then we would have it, then we might actually end up with a different kind of project. So it's an open kind of story in some ways. It's not simply that the project defines the nature of the geography. The geography can also, in some instances, start to define the nature of the project. And it's that dialectic that it seems to me is important to acknowledge. Now, you can go across all of these institutions in these kinds of ways and start to look at the specific ways in which geographical knowledges get produced. But then there are two issues I would want to raise about this. The first issue is one of the ways in which conflict works is precisely over the nature of the geographical knowledge. And it becomes an issue in all sorts of settings. Now, Mehta, when he's talking about liberalism and empire, and when I was talking about cosmopolitanism, kind of ended up concluding, both of us, that in many instances, the devil lies in the geographical details. And if you don't get the geographical details right, then you've got, you know, you can have all these wonderful kinds of ethical principles, but you're in deep trouble when it comes to actually working something out on the ground. Now, if that is the case, then conflict over principles can often be fought out in terms of conflict over the nature of the geographical knowledge deployed. I'll give you just two examples. When there was revolutions afoot in Central America, led primarily by the Sandinistas, but there were many others going on in El Salvador and the like, there was an incredible kind of history at that particular moment of how that conflict was depicted. On the one hand, you had the State Department and Reagan and all those people kind of saying, this has to be understood geopolitically. And the way you understand it geopolitically is that this is communist penetration into the Western Hemisphere. And there was a fantastic sort of propaganda thing set out by the State Department, which was circulated around, and it had this wonderful kind of depiction that they had a map of the Caribbean and southern United States, and Cuba was red, and then Nicaragua became red, and then El Salvador became red, and then Guatemala went red, and then Mexico went red, and then all of a sudden Texas went red. And he thought this is a wonderful kind of thing. But what they were trying to do with this whole thing is to actually use this whole kind of notion of this spreading cancer, which was moving up and was going to take over and be a really serious threat to the United States. There was absolutely no attempt in any of the State Department literature to deal with questions of political conditions in those countries, or of social conditions, or conditions of land ownership, or anything of that kind. To get that kind of information, you found a number of sources which actually were really trying to modify US foreign policy towards this region, simply by saying, look, there is a different kind of problem here to this. And one of the sources, which was crucial, was Oxfam, which produced a whole series of wonderful reports about the ways in which populations were being thrown off the main, most important, and most, you know, the most fertile land, and put onto marginalized land where they couldn't make a living. They had to become temporary wage workers on the plantations, and how this whole question of displacement was occurring, and what the social consequences of that were for village structures, social community development, and the like. So here is Oxfam kind of saying, no, the roots of this problem lie somewhere else. The religious organizations who were very active in Nicaragua were similarly producing the same kinds of information. The religious-based communities in Nicaragua were producing this kind of information. And so here you find this was often fought out in terms of local groups from the churches and from Oxfam and so on, trying to go around the country, trying to get to legislators to kind of say, look, these are the conditions you need to address. If you don't address these conditions, then these revolutions are going to continue. And any resolution to these revolutions has to acknowledge the importance of and significance of these conditions. Otherwise, you're just going to get the same thing happening all over again. And in this instance, it was after a while, it became a specific attempt to mobilize a different geographical understanding of what existed in Central America, who was there, who was doing what to whom, what the conditions of life were like, what daily life was like, and in order to combat an alternative political position. A second example would be the ways in which, for example, the World Bank has typically depicted actually had a sort of geographical vision. In the 1960s, the World Bank essentially thought of the world as being partitioned up into a whole bunch of independent states. Each independent state was going to go through a whole kind of process of development, which was largely understood, I think, in terms of sort of Rustow's stages of economic growth, in which you went through the takeoff into economic growth, and then you got the drive to mass consumption, and then you got mass consumption society. And each country was then, when it got to mass consumption society, was going to be safe from communism, because remember, the World Bank was a Cold War institution, and its mission was very much caught up with what the Cold War was about. But it saw the world as these independent entities. And these independent entities were negotiated with, and there was this attempt to push them in this kind of way. Well, most of that project sort of failed, and then it became a much more sort of neoliberal kind of institution. But then it found itself forced by a number of external critics to start to rethink what kind of geographical world it was working in. There was, first of all, the very strong criticism that came from the NGOs, particularly the environmental NGOs. And essentially what Greenpeace and others did was to start to say, look, the place where this new dam is going is not a sort of an empty area in which you're going to put this whole kind of pristine sort of piece of modernist architecture which is going to deliver electricity to everybody and make everybody better off. It's not that at all. It's a populated territory. It has a history and it has a culture. There are diversity of habitats which need to be considered. There's a diversity of life forms. There's biodiversity and the like. And so what the Greenpeace did was to start to say it's a different world. It's not the same as you're talking about. And of course, you as a public person, if you are subjected to just the World Bank position, you say, yeah, this is not a bad idea. It looks like it's a good idea. I'll go along with that. But when Greenpeace comes along and says, no, look, there are indigenous populations being displaced. There's whole ways of life which are being destroyed. There are whole kind of cultural artifacts which are being ruined. There are ways of life and habitats. And then you kind of say, well, maybe this isn't such a good idea. And it becomes much more problematic. Here, too, a lot of the argument was fought out in terms of the geographical context in which it was understood that this dam was going to be placed. And here, too, what you're seeing is a specific use of geographical, a particular kind of geographical knowledge as a political weapon in some kind of struggle. And at some point or other, the World Bank had to acknowledge, yeah, well, maybe that territory is like that. So it's not just resources, it's also habitat. So it started to change its language. And Robert Wade, who is here, has done a wonderful study of the whole sort of greening of the World Bank and how the World Bank actually took on some of these more environmental things under these sorts of pressures and developed a different kind of geographical knowledge. If you look at the last World Bank development report, you'll see a very different language from that which you saw 15 years ago. The contemporary language acknowledges there's such a thing as civil society. They didn't know there was such a thing as civil society 20 years ago. They just thought there was a state. And they now kind of think the civil society is rather important in terms of what they do. They didn't realize there was an environment 20, 30 years ago. They just recognized there were resources there to be extracted and utilized in some sort of political and economic project. So here you see a transformation in the knowledge structure, which is actually as a result of political pressure. And that political pressure in transforming that knowledge structure then actually starts to shift the nature of World Bank decision making, so it starts to look at things in a rather different light. And it is those kinds of struggles over the geographical knowledge structure that seem to me to be crucially important in terms of understanding the dynamics of a lot of what happens in terms of political action. Now, in making these arguments, I'm also indicating, I think, by terms of the sort of list of things that I've mentioned, I'm also indicating that there's a vast array of geographical knowledges out there, a vast array. And it's therefore extremely difficult ever to get the idea that it may be possible to make any kind of sense of it. So the question then arises, well, is it really almost in the form that Kant left it to us, incoherent, sort of just sort of anecdotic, particular, and impossible to sort of put together into any kind of general frame? And if I make the argument that, well, we should be talking about plurals of knowledges instead of singulars, then How can we actually even start to contemplate the question of what a proper kind of geographical knowledge would be, and what sort of ways in which we could understand the role of geographical knowledge in general in political economic development and in political economic change? Now, I want to address this by suggesting that while I would resist the idea that there's an essentialist definition of the discipline, there are a number of components to all forms of geographical knowledge, independent of where they're coming from, and it's important to look at those components as being fundamental, because it's through those components, I think, that we can start to evolve what I would call a critical geographical perspective. And there are four components. The first component is what I'll call cartographic consciousness. And cartographic consciousness is about a mapping of the world, a mental mapping of the world, but also in some cases a tangible physical mapping of the world. And that cartographic consciousness is about locating. It's about individuating. It's about situating things and events in relationship to other things and events. And in a sense, it's defining a little bit who we are. Who we are is partly defined by where we are. And that cartographic consciousness then becomes very significant. And I think it undermines in lots of ways the whole kind of notion that you can ever have a cosmopolitan ethic that isn't situated somehow. Because I think as soon as we start to think about cartographic consciousness, every cosmopolitan project is situated somewhere, and we have to acknowledge that particular situatedness. So the cartographic consciousness then is significant. It has evolved over time. And it rotates at some point or other around the question of what kind of map of the world do you have in your head? What kind of map of social relations exists? What kind of map of spatial relations, and how do we understand those spatial relations very explicitly? So that's the first component. And there's no form of geographical knowledge that doesn't have embedded in it some kind of notion of cartographic consciousness. And I think it's important to look at that cartographic consciousness, however it's articulated, however it's represented, whether it's in formal mapping or whether it's just simply in the way in which people think they understand their positionality in the world. The second element is what I call the measure of space-time. And here, too, what we're looking at is a way of understanding what I would call the social construction of space and time, how different societies produce different notions of spatiotemporality, locate themselves in relationship to different kinds of physical spatiotemporalities, and understand their relationship to them. And this idea of spatiotemporality has within it three very specific components. The first is a very simple argument about what kind of space horizon are we looking at? What kind of time horizon are we looking at? If we make decisions which are purely based on something that's intensely local and short term, then we make decisions which are fundamentally different from those which have a sort of a much larger spatial horizon and a much longer temporal horizon. So there is first then that question of horizon. What is the horizon? The second question is exactly what metric do we use? We're fond of thinking that science gives us very specific metrics of space and spatiotemporality and the like. But actually those metrics don't always work out in terms of psychological, subjective understandings and symbolic understandings of the world. God's time and God's space looks very different from scientific space and scientific time, and the whole kind of religious development of notions of spatiotemporality puts you in a completely different frame of mind in terms of what you do and how you do it than the scientific one. So there are different measures of space-time, and while we can look at those different measures of space-time, I would like to argue that all forms of geographical knowledge at some point or other articulate and represent a specific kind of definition of spatiotemporality. And there is a third element within this, which is the problem of scale. At what scale do we actually make decisions? And what scale are we thinking about? And the scalar issue is actually fundamental in scientific research because unless you've got your scales right, you've got a real difficulty on your hands. But it's also very important from the standpoint of political economic understanding and from the standpoint of political work. I mean, do we think of ourselves as belonging to a neighbourhood, to a nation, to the European Union, to the globe? At what scale are we defining ourselves, and how is that scale articulated? And at what scale should we think of our activities? At what scale, for example, should unions organise? Should they organise just in the local plant, or should they actually organise at a European level? There are all these sorts of questions which need to be sort of thought about, so that here too the question of scale starts to come to the fore. But as soon as you raise the question of scale, it seems to me you're in a position to start to ask questions about, well, what kind of scale are we thinking about here? And it's clear that, for example, environmental issues that make sense at one scale don't make sense at another scale. Environmental solutions that make sense at one scale don't make sense at another scale. And we're not very good at articulating relationships between things that need to happen at one scale in relationship to things that need to be done at another scale. And those being one of the big pressing problems, it seems to me, is to start to think those sorts of issues through much more carefully. So the measure of space-time, then, is a very important element. But it's there in all kinds of geographical knowledges. And again, I want to insist, I'm not talking about just what goes on in geography, I'm talking about, you know, how does the World Bank think about that question? How does the CIA think about that question? How do the military think about that question? How does Greenpeace think about that question? You know, I mean, these are all ways. It's a way of thinking which you're going to find embedded in all of those disparate knowledges. The third major element in the thing is what I would call the question of territoriality, regionality, locality, or place, or whatever, a large variety of words that can be used about it. Because I think there's no question that social organization is such as to start to define, through that process of bonding that I mentioned, certain kinds of ways in which we have an effective relationship to a particular place and start to think of that place as an entity that has a meaning in itself. The almost obvious sort of container of our affections tends to be the nation state, but it's not the only one. There can be regional consciousness, there can be regionality of various kinds. People become attached to neighborhoods, they become attached to particular places. And the significance of place to identity formation is absolutely crucial. And of course, it's one of the elements which, when I was, you know, sort of mentioning the whole kind of liberal dilemma, it's one of the elements that's crucial in the critique of liberalism or cosmopolitanism. Individuals are not deracinated. They actually come from a place. And where they come from is significant, and the placidness of things and the placidness of people starts to become a very significant element in how politics is worked out. But then there's also the question of scale about region. At what scale do we define a region? Is it just simply the scale of my body? Is it the scale of my sort of neighborhood block? At what scale do I define the region? And to what scale do I start to express affection? Can I have affection at multiple scales? Can I love the nation state and also my neighborhood? And then what do I do when the nation state starts to do nasty things to my neighborhood? You know, and which one do I go for? So the whole kind of question of territoriality and the formation of territoriality and of placidness and regionality is a crucial issue. And how certain territories get defined and territorial definitions get set up is absolutely crucial in human affairs. And how those territories also, at a certain point or other, can start to behave in exclusionary ways. Keep out signs, gated communities, nation states putting up immigration barriers, sort of informal mechanisms, sometimes violence and coercion, to keep unwanted people out, getting the homeless people out of the streets and sticking them somewhere else, all those kinds of questions. So then there's a rivalry that occurs between different regions, so that you get a geopolitical dimension to this, a geopolitical infighting between, well, is this territory going to be advantaged or is that territory going to be advantaged? What happens when the United States is having trouble with its steel industry? Does it have the right to sort of protect it, you know? And what does that mean for all other territories? So geopolitical rivalries then start to emerge out of this whole kind of question of territoriality, regionality, and nation-state formation. The last element in the argument is to say all of these systems of geographical knowledge that I know also are deeply concerned with the whole issue of what I would call the dialectics of socio-ecological change. That is, the whole kind of question of transformations of nature, transformations of human nature, how they go together, how political projects are ecological projects, how ecological projects are political projects, and what the relationship is between those kinds of dimensions to political and economic and ecological life. And this whole kind of relation to nature sort of angle is obviously crucial, because we're not only talking about nature in the sort of external sense, we're also talking about our relationship to the built environment, how the built environment is being transformed, how new configurations are being developed, which offer new possibilities for different forms of life, different ways of life, and the like. Now, my argument here is that any form of geographical knowledge combines those four components. And if it does so, then it seems to me what we have here is the foundation for what I would call a critical geographical theory. And what critical geography does is to ask those questions. What kind of map is in people's heads? What would happen to this policy if the map changed? If we substituted a different map? Whose map is it that gets put there? Who has the power to put that map there? Why do I let George Bush put that map there rather than me put that map there? These are the kinds of questions. Then the question of spatio-temporality. What is the spatio-temporal horizon upon which things are working? What is the definition of spatio-temporality? Why is it that the temporality of financial, spatio-temporality of financial institutions is so totally inconsistent with even the spatio-temporality of certain production systems, which is even further inconsistent with the spatio-temporality of, say, our needs as human beings to raise kids and do things of that sort? I mean, you have these different spatio-temporal definitions, and it seems to me we have a way of starting to say, look, do we want that spatio-temporal form to dominate our lives? Do we want the spatio-temporality of Wall Street to be so hegemonic? And if we don't want it to be hegemonic, then whose spatio-temporality is going to be dominant? And here there is, again, this kind of critical kind of question of what kind of spatio-temporality do we have? The regionality question is, again, a sort of, now what kind of regions are you defining? What kinds of territories? And how are you thinking about that territory? Is it exclusive? Is it going to be a sort of a neo-fascist enclave? Are you going to keep everybody else out that doesn't look like you? Is it going to be a gated community? Is it going to be homogeneous? And, you know, how is that territory being looked at? So here, too, is a foundation for a critical interrogation of all those forms of knowledge, so that you can ask of the World Bank, where do you get those territorial units from? Why are you using those and not others? And what would happen if you substituted a different set of territorial units? And what would happen if you substituted a different sense of spatio-temporality? And finally, this whole kind of question of the relation to nature, the dialectics of socio-environmental ecological change. Here, too, the question is, well, what kind of political project do we have if we accept the dialectical view that in transforming the world we transform ourselves? Then why are we not thinking about what kinds of transformations of the world we're undertaking in relationship to the kinds of social beings we want to be? And how do we think about that relationship? And why is it that certain kinds of spatio-temporal, certain kinds of environmental transformations preclude the possibility of certain alternatives in terms of social relations? One of the things I have, for example, against nuclear power is precisely that it commits you for a very, very, very long time to all kinds of social institutional structures in order to keep those things from blowing up and going bad and going rotten. And those social institutions are not necessarily consistent with the idea of any kind of participatory democracy. I mean, the last thing in the world I would want when a nuclear power station goes bad is to sort of have a participatory meeting to find out what to do about it. I mean, but this is exactly what the problem is, that you see some of these things actually commit us. We have committed ourselves in terms of the nature of the built environments and the environmental transformations we have already wrought to certain ways of life and to certain political institutions which we can't escape for a very long time, and it's going to be very hard to transform. So here, too, there is a point of critical engagement by asking questions about what is the concept of environmental, socio-ecological transformation. What is the concept that is at work in each one of these kinds of one of these kinds of areas? So I would like to suggest then that we could forge a critical geography a critical form of geographical knowledge around that, those elements, and that we could integrate that with critical theory, and even start to try to integrate it with general theory, because there is an incredible intellectual difficulty in all of this, which is how to confront the deracinated politics of liberalism or neoliberalism or cosmopolitanism with many of these ideas about, you know, rootedness and all the rest of it, without falling into the Heideggerian trap, which in political terms, without falling into sort of exclusionary, localist, particularist kinds of fascisms, which are seen very often as the only response available to globalization. So that seems to me to be part of the political intellectual problem. But that then leads into another aspect, which is to ask the question, is there something which we might call an emancipatory geography? That is a way in which we can start to think through the critical analysis that I've suggested into a more programmatic kind of way of kind of saying, well, are there ways to think about spatiotemporality which are more liberatory in relationship to human possibilities and capacities and desires? Are there ways to think about notions of place? Because I'm not against the rootedness in place at all, but it seems to me if it becomes exclusionary and all the rest of it, that's where the problems really start. And how do we actually think through this kind of question of the dialectics of the socio-ecological transformation, and how do we think through this kind of cartographic consciousness? Are there ways to think that through which can connect to some sort of emancipatory project which can be antagonistic to what neoliberalism is about? Because right now what's happening is we're seeing a reconfiguration, and I mentioned this sort of regulatory kind of try to keep neoliberalism under wraps, try to give it a regulatory framework. But in trying to do that, there is very little concern with the nature of the geographical kinds of underpinnings of what that might be about. And it seems to me we do have the possibility, by linking together many of the geographical conceptions which exist in many of the oppositional groups, the kinds of groups that turned up in Seattle or Genoa and all the rest of it, to kind of say, look, there are some commonalities here. And the commonalities exist within the difference, and is there a politics that can grow out of those commonalities? And I would suggest to you that one of the issues right now in terms of oppositional politics to neoliberalism is precisely the fragmentation. And it's geographical fragmentation as much as it is fragmentation along sort of secular lines and the like. And that geographical fragmentation has to be paid careful attention to. Asking ourselves the question, what is the commonality between, say, something like the Zapatista movement, the participatory democracy experiments in Porto Alegre, the sort of justice for janitors movements in Los Angeles and Washington, D.C. What's the commonality in all of those movements? And are there ways to bring them together in a different kind of vein? And I would like to suggest that a sort of an emancipatory geographical project won't answer the question, but it has to be a crucial part of the answer. Because if not, we're going to probably fall back into exactly all of those errors, which it seems to me has bedeviled the left over the years, which is to have the great theoretical abstract ideas, but when it comes down to the rootedness of questions, to be unable to cope in a very, very sophisticated and meaningful way with what that rootedness in geographical and anthropological and historical reality is really all about. And it seems to me that seems to be part of the intellectual challenge. That intellectual challenge, like go back to one of my first points, seems to me you're only going to be able to answer, not by kind of saying you should all become geographers, but by simply saying, look, we have to bury a lot of these differences, even within academia, between geography, anthropology, and sociology, and all the rest of it, and particularly economics, by the way. And if we can do that, then it seems to me we wouldn't be in a position to create a revitalized critical theory, because I have to say I think critical theory in general has lost its heft, it's lost its kind of sense of what the hell it's supposed to be critical of. Part of that is from other critical theorists. And to revitalize that critical theory into what seems to me a set of possibilities right now, which is going to involve a lot of intellectual reconstruction amongst ourselves, as well as a lot of opening up to what's going on in the rest of the world. Okay, I'll leave it there. Thanks very much.
David Harvey's kindly offered to take some questions. There are a couple of roving mics, I think, upstairs as well as downstairs. Is there a roving mic up? Yeah. So if you could put your hand up and wait till the mic comes to you, then we'll take some questions. Could you pass this one here?
What I wanted to ask is actually something quite simple. You were talking a lot about a development of a critical geography at the later part of your lecture. In the first part of your lecture, you mentioned all these sites of power that create a geography of knowledge. Now, basically, how can we, even if we develop a critical theory of geography, don't you think that you're slightly understating the influence of these sites of power? Because if I were, let's say, I would be an Argentinian trying to critically ask why are they called the Falklands and not the Malvinas, I'll probably get an answer. If I would try and do a kind of a conscious cartographic exercise of Jerusalem, I could probably also get to that thing. And the same thing would probably go for Taiwan, I mean, China, Taipei. So, and if it's not understated, so how do we escape kind of restructuring these knowledges of power, which might affect the way that we're doing conscious cartography and things like that?
You know, one of the reasons I think it's very important to take a very realistic approach to how geographical knowledges get produced is precisely to recognize the nature of the problem that you're talking about. And to look very closely at the specific ways in which knowledges get produced in those institutional settings. There's one point here that I want to make. The first is that it's never the case that the knowledge produced in the institution is perfectly functional for what it's trying to do. They often screw up. I mean, you know, they hit the wrong embassy or something, you know. They get the wrong address on one of those, you know. And I think it's important to recognize that there's a certain kind of a vulnerability within those institutions that they often don't know exactly how to revitalize and reform their geographical knowledge structure, which then gives an opportunity for actually people inside of those institutions, and I know people inside of these institutions who try to do this, which is to try to kind of say, well, if that's not working, then we should really be thinking about it this way, and then try to sort of put in something which actually starts to shift the strategy a little bit. So there's always that question of internal contradictions within the institutions and the knowledge structures produced. And then there are the issues of the external contradictions. I mentioned, for instance, the World Bank. Well, you know, the World Bank is a pretty powerful institution, but it's changed its knowledge structure as a result of external critique. And again, I think that is not an insignificant development. But the World Bank is still the World Bank, and it still does a lot of the things that the World Bank does. So again, I don't think that this is an easy kind of question. And I mean, you can either kind of say, look, these institutions are going to do what they're going to do anyway, which in many cases is the case. I despair of getting the government to the other side of the United States to the other side of the Atlantic to do anything other than what it's doing. I mean, there's no amount of geographical argument that's going to change their minds. They've got it set and they've got it fixed and they're going to go ahead and they're going to do it. And I think that's an extraordinarily distressing thing. But then at that point, there's a question of public opinion, and at what point can you actually start to invade public opinion and start to actually make sure that lot get voted out next time around. I mean those kinds of questions come in. No, it's a, you know, you can't change political power structures overnight. There's a vast amount of knowledge production there. There are critical geographers around working in some of those institutions, actually. And you know, it's possible to start to work with them. But I think that what is bothering me most of all right now is almost a complete unawareness of how, you know, you can have these wonderful kind of ethical kinds of principles and then apply them in these geographical contexts where they actually produce these kinds of total disasters. And I think if only that simple awareness can be got across, that people might actually have a second thought about some of the things which get done. I actually think that in the United States they have a vested interest in geographical ignorance. And I think that they like it that nobody understands anything about the rest of the world, because then that allows a small elite to go ahead and do all these things and define things in exactly the way they want. I mean, they can define Saudi Arabia as a good place, even though what's going on it is absolutely horrendous. When most Americans find out what's going on in it, they think it's horrendous. But then they kind of define Libya as an evil place, and they could go bomb Libya, and they don't bomb Saudi Arabia, you see, and you kind of go, well, you know, how did that come about, you know? And I mean, if they're really going to go sort of deal with barbarians and savages and evil empires and evil things like that, then why don't they look at Saudi Arabia, you know? I mean, in terms of their terms, I'm not in favor of these terms myself at all. But I think these are broad issues, and I think you're right, you know. I mean, it's not as if a few of us who develop some sort of notion of critical geography are going to change the world radically overnight. But it's got to begin somewhere, and it's got to begin, I think, mainly within academia and in some of the institutions which are considering these questions.
Okay. Ask questions, gentlemen down here. Excuse me, Stuart. Woo. No, down below. Sorry, the gentleman here.
Yes, the question relates to Halford Mackinder. How do you look at Halford Mackinder, the founder of the Royal Geographical Society, and his anti-Russian obsessions? Thank you.
Oh, well, yeah, I was the Halford Mackinder Professor of Geography at Oxford some time ago, and I thought it was an amusing thing to be, given who he was. He's a Conservative Member of Parliament, for those of you who don't know, and he was a great defender of British imperialism and a great defender of a certain kind of geopolitics. And of course, we like to think that it was only Hitler who followed geopolitical strategies, but in fact, Halford Mackinder and some of the French, like de Montjean and so on, also followed them. And there was a whole sort of period of thinking about how to maintain the. I mean, it's a bit like a sort of vast containment policy of the world, and how to maintain the world free for British imperialism was what it was all about. And this is there's been a long history of connection, of course, between geography and imperialism, and that's been well looked at now and well thought about now. A lot of people have looked at it. But I think there's also been within the geography tradition and a tradition of anti-imperialism. Yeah, there are a lot of figures within who tried to define things in a different kind of way. So, you know, Halford Mackinder was one of those who was into using geographical knowledge in a very specific way. And he gave a very famous statement to, I think it was the Council on Foreign Relations in something like 1940 or 42, like that, in New York, where he was strongly urging that the United States play a very crucial role in defending the free world by making sure that Russia didn't penetrate too far into Eastern Europe, and that this was his view that if the Russians got as far as Germany, then they would dominate the world system, and this had to be stopped at almost any price. And so here's a sort of piece of geographical advice coming from an eminent geographer.
I'd like to thank David Harvey for a wonderful talk, but just thinking about the body of the talk and the interest in history, I was struck by what seemed to me like a bit of a gap, and I'd just like to ask about it. You were extremely critical and scathing about cosmopolitanism, liberalism, neoliberalism. The word Marxism didn't appear, and the word communism only appeared in relation to Central America, where we could, of course, have talked about Soviet intervention in the Horn of Africa if we felt like it. And of course, the United States, as Hobsbawm has pointed out, is a revolutionary state and does want people to be like that. And there have, of course, been other revolutionary states. But certainly, actually existing socialism was coercive, exclusive, disciplinarian, vis-a-vis local populations, whether white, black, or brown, was patronizing and paternalistic through the system of vanguardism. I would just like to wonder what your view of all that is and why you left it out. Do you think it's so much of a dead duck it's not worth spending time on? And if it is a dead duck, how did it die in your terms?
Yeah, I'd like to clarify. I'm not against cosmopolitanism. I think there's a certain kind of cosmopolitanism that I would certainly like to rescue. I'm not even against liberalism, neoliberalism I am, but liberalism I think has some very profound principles which I would be very happy to sign on to. If you can get away from some of the, I mean, this whole kind of deracinated individual kind of thing. At the end of my talk, I did say that unless we're prepared to rethink some of these questions, we're going to make a lot of the mistakes of the sort that the left has made over the years. And I would mention as one example of that, for instance, the Sandinistas, when they came to power, didn't understand much about the Mesquite Indian populations on the Pacific, on the Atlantic coast. And their whole attempt to integrate the Mesquite Indians was based on a theory of development which I think was fundamentally erroneous. Now it so happened that there was a famous, a very good geographer, a guy called Barney Nietschmann, who wrote a fabulous book about the Mesquite Indians and what they were about. And my feeling is, had the Sandinistas read and absorbed that, they might not have gone at the Mesquite Indians in terms of their developmental project in the way they did, which was coercive in terms of land redistribution and the like. This, of course, tragically allowed the CIA to enter in with the Contras, to use the Mesquite Indians as the sort of discontented faction which allowed the Contra War to unfold. And then, of course, having, as it were, got rid of the Sandinistas, as happened with the Taliban and everybody else, what did the CIA do? It just walked away and just left them high and dry, you know. And so I think there is a history there about of left politics. And I think one of my big struggles within Marxism has been to try to make Marxists much more sensitive to these geographical issues. And in fact, my whole life has been a lot of the time been taken up with fighting within the Marxist camp to say, well, you know, you should be much more sensitive about these other issues. And unless you are, then you're going to get, you know, a lot of your projects are going to go wrong. It's been very hard to get people to listen to me on that score. So I think this is a very significant point. Again, it goes back to the nature of the social theory, which we actually embrace. And nearly all the social theories we have are social theories which start off with the notion of some sort of deracinated individual who, you know, and it seems to me the only theory that doesn't do that is the sort of Heideggerian stuff, and I don't want to go there. So the big question is, well, how do you actually start to take these, you know, put it in very simple terms. I don't want to end up with a sort of being saying everything's so particular you can't generalize. There are no universal principles. I believe there are universal principles, and I would want to advocate those universal principles. But those universal principles have to be worked out in such a way that they allow for a great deal of diversity and divergence and actually incorporate within them in some way an acknowledgement of some of the themes that I've been talking about into, you know, those four elements, and try to acknowledge those the significance and importance of those questions and the way those principles get articulated.
Question.
I welcome the general discourse drawing attention to what I also think is an urgent need for some broad critical geographic theory.
Sorry, can you just hear at the back?
Is it not
the mic on? Can you hold it a bit closer?
Okay. I'm sorry. Could everybody hear that?
Yes.
Yeah. And in particular, the need to seek and establish and agree some set of principles by which you draw together the disparate and conflicting threads of separate corporate and institutional action. I wonder if you agree with me that to some extent geography has become a subordinate discipline in the field of academia and pushed to the margins, when in fact its primacy is not marginal at all, but is underpinning and overarching and transcends all these divisions. I wonder if you can point in some directions where you think critical theory may start or may have already started, and what you think of my perception that the theories of central place of about 50 years ago by Chris Stahler were in fact discarded, as I understand, in speaking to various planners, as being a theoretical dead end without practical application. Mm. Could it be that if those insights and that evidence were used more pragmatically, more empirically, that we could in fact make some progress?
You know, Kant took the view that, I mean, his actual anthropological knowledge and his geographical knowledge is really, you know, well, it's just crap, you know. So, but what he did insist upon in his general theoretical writings was that he called it a condition of possibility of all understanding of the world, and a condition of possibility of all application of theoretical principles to the world is contained within geography, anthropology, and history. So he actually took the view that in principle about the organization of knowledge, that these were crucial fields, absolutely crucial fields for the discovery of knowledge and also for the application of knowledge. And I think he was right in that. And I think that therefore we have to situate those knowledges in that way. This doesn't, however, necessarily mean they're overarching or they're. I mean, you know, occasionally this notion of synthesis comes along. I don't think they're synthetic in that sense, and I don't think they're overarching, but they are absolutely fundamental. And when I say conditions of possibility, I really mean that they are conditions of possibility. And unless those conditions are fulfilled, they're all like, almost like necessary conditions for doing anything in an adequate kind of way. The problem, it seems to me, with some of the forms of geographical theory that were laid out by people like Chris Stahler and dynamics of locational theory and Lersch and all the rest of it, which I'm still very attracted to in lots of ways, the problem is that often their notions of spatiotemporality were formulaic. I mean, the big problem with applying a Chris Stahler scheme is, at what scale do you define it? At what kind of spatiotemporality are you thinking about? And a critical, if I took the sort of principles of critical geography to the sort of Chris Stahler style thinking, I think I would kind of say, well, you can see why it is that these proposals, which became so formulaic, essentially failed, because, you know, you laid out a central place network on, I don't know, the Dutch polders or something like that, assuming everybody was going around on a bicycle, and then they all got automobiles, and then there was no, it's irrelevant, you know. So again, it's these questions of spatiotemporality, of placidness, and so on come back in, which doesn't mean, but I think, again, what often happens is people kind of say, oh, it didn't work, so we don't have to have any theory anymore. So we back away from any kind of theory at all. And it seems to me that's the wrong kind of thing. I think what a critical geography would do would be try to revitalize theory by asking these kinds of questions about, well, are there ways to rewrite this theory in such a way that it actually takes account of the radical ways in which the scales of activities are being transformed by technological changes and the like.
Okay, question down here.
There's a couple up there, too.
Thank you. And I just had a question. I mean, if we are to embark on, or I suppose embrace, these emancipatory geographies, if it might do us well to acknowledge how explicitly gendered they are, it seems that the imperialist project, for example, was not only about sort of defining others and not only about creating a kind of moral space, but of course it was an explicitly gendered space. Mm-hmm. Discourses of tourism, discourses of the environment, and certainly of the nation. And I feel that, you know, if we are going to chart some kind of project that tries to re-envision our understandings of identity and place, etc., and also production of privileged knowledge, that we need to understand that kind of fundamental aspect of it.
I agree.
Answer.
What? Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, I, it, it's this is a very important dimension to the argument. There are multiple dimensions. I mean, you know, if you start to disaggregate the argument in terms of, for instance, what I mean, identity politics, or you start to disaggregate it in terms of class versus, you know, just simply in class terms, you start to find the project has a whole set of differentiations within it. I mean, my view of this is that you know, the point of a critical geographical project is precisely to try to talk about social relations and different forms of social relations, which obviously has a lot to do with gender relations as well as with class relations and the like. So I want to sort of talk about all of those as part of what any emancipatory project is about.
Squeeze one last question in back there.
Hello, thank you for a very good lecture indeed. Just thinking, obviously theory is excessively important, but at the same time can also be lost while everyone theorizes. In the light of Tony Blair and Claire Short's recent visits to Africa, what advice, if any, would you actually give regarding development of the third world?
Well, you know, this is one of the things that I kind of, I hate to put it in this category, but I used to go through U.S. immigration, and they used to ask me what I did, and I said I was a geographer, and I stopped doing that after a while, because they immediately said, what's the highest mountain in? and I never knew the answer, you see, and then they thought, well, they started to get very suspicious. They thought I was a fraud, you know. They said, well, what's the longest river then? And you kind of... I mean, the question you're asking is a very serious question, but I really feel in a topic of this of that depth. I mean, that would require something that has a whole set of expertise that I don't particularly possess. What I could talk about in very practical terms is things like, you know, what the hell are we going to do in New York now, and how the hell are we going to understand what happened and things like that. I'd be willing to talk about those kinds of things in very practical kinds of ways, because I'm connected to a lot of those issues, and so I don't want to sort of get into ex cathedra statements about you know, things that I have a very shallow understanding of, and I and the role of theory and theoretical thinking, it seems to me, is a lot of the time is not to sort of have a total embrace of everything that's going on in the world. It's to develop a kind of critical perspective so that you can ask questions about, well, if this is the development strategy that's being proposed for certain parts of Africa, and if this is the way the AIDS crisis is being approached, then is this the right way? The answer is I haven't done enough work on the ground. I can go talk to my anthropology colleagues and find out, if you like. I mean, but that would take something else from me, than something that I don't actually have.
I think we'll draw it to a close there. I'd like to thank David Harvey for his fascinating lecture, which.